The very biggest thing, mistake that you can make is to overpay for an asset and or undercapitalize an asset. Things are not always going to be smooth and easy, and that's just not the way real estate works. You're not buying a T-bill. It's not the exact same revenue and payout every month. Don't have that expectation. That would be my biggest thing. I'd say the second thing is who manages it. The number one factor is definitely what you pay for the asset.
As an operator, I know other investors are romanticizing multifamily investing, and I'm looking to learn from other investors' mistakes. I know you are too, and you found the right place. Welcome to Myers Methods Presents Multifamily Missteps.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to Myers Methods Presents Multifamily Missteps. I'm your host, Jerome, and I have Ryan Wehner on the line with me today. Ryan, how are you?
Good. Living the dream.
Looks like you're in Hawaii, man. What's going on? I thought you were in...
I have an old picture from Costa Rica that I have in the background.
I went to Costa Rica. They've got some really cool wild caves down there, man. But, you know, if the listeners want to learn more about your huge company, what's the best way for them to do that?
I think the best way to do an initial reach out to us would be go through our website and or just email at info@wehnermultifamily.com. Our receptionist will bring that message right to me. And, you know, I'd love to give out my cell number and stuff, but I'd be answering too many phone calls and I wouldn't be able to keep a thought straight.
So for those of you who don't know, these guys manage over 26,000 units across the U.S. And that is just, plus they do construction management and a bunch of other stuff, but I don't want to steal all your thunder, Ryan. Why don't you give the listeners a little bit about your background and what you're currently focused on?
Okay, I'll just give you the elevator version of what we talked about earlier, which is, you know, I started the business about 13 years ago, just managing my own buildings and gradually grew into the third-party business. We've doubled every 2 years for the first 10 years of our business, and we're still at a very big growth rate. And we also do about $20 million in construction management a year. It could be GC work or construction management. We have over 1,000 employees in those two businesses. And then we also have proprietary products that we've developed that we source directly from China. And they're all very high quality, low price. And we provide them exclusively to our clients at this point. And I mean, that's really the elevator pitch. I would say the 26,000 units, I would say about 18,000 of those are in DFW. We have a large presence in Oklahoma City, and then we have about 3,000 units in San Antonio, a little over 1,000 in Austin, and then we're up and down the I-35 corridor from Austin to DFW, and then we have a small presence in Tulsa and Abilene. So we're only in Texas and Oklahoma at this point.
It's hard to believe that there's that many doors in just those two. Well, you said something in California too, right?
I grew up in Southern California, but I don't manage anything in California. And that would take a whole nother HR department to start a business there.
Yeah, California is kind of rough. And I don't know if I want to be a landlord in California or managing in California with all the rent controls and other stuff going
on. Right. It's just a different business. I'm sure as a fee manager, you can make money, but it's just not in our wheelhouse. We primarily focus, I mean, look, about 60% of our buildings are, or I would say about 50% are C, C plus, and about 50% are B to B plus. And we have a handful of A properties, but that's really our bread and butter, kind of that workforce housing, kind of the blue collar housing, all the way up to, you know, maybe your first or second job out of college type of living situations.
Yeah, that's actually the market we focus on, so I'm gonna be super selfish today. Let's dive into it, man. I mean, you guys manage a ton of units. You get to see all kinds of data. Like, what type of missteps are you seeing owners do? Like, I mean, I think that's probably the best conversation because you have so many different touch points. Like,
yeah, I would rather talk generally about missteps that I've experienced over. I mean, there's obviously some stuff that's pretty fresh given the current climate, but you know, most of the problems that are arising right now are a function of what people did over the last at least 2 years. So it's, you know, if you didn't correctly capitalize an apartment deal, if you underwrote, if you were leading the market on rent growth projections, you know, always thinking that greener pastures were ahead, and you didn't correctly capitalize, or you over leveraged or overpaid. That's typically the biggest misstep that it's very hard to kind of reverse. So, I mean, look, if we get into a pretty flat or even healthy recession going forward, most clients that have capitalized properly, that, you know, kind of have that contingency money in their bank and don't scrape every bit of money out every month, they're going to be okay. I mean, it's one of those things that they'll live to fight another day. If you went in with very short-term debt, highly leveraged, and aren't correctly capitalized, when I say capitalized, that you don't have enough contingency capital to deal with a downturn or an issue with regards to the physical asset, like a chiller going out, and you have to write a $70,000 check. If you're not capitalized in terms of that, that when you put the deal together, that you didn't underwrite, you know, not worst case scenario, but at least a bad case, then I think a lot of those people are going to have issues here in the next year. We also see, I would say, in the short term, you know, and I fully empathize that a lot of people are in a very stressful situation. But they have to remember that we're in real estate. Real estate is very dependent on relationships. I think anybody who's had success in this business knows it's mainly about relationships. And where I would say kind of, I don't want to get too Dr. Phil here, but don't burn on people right now. I know you people have a stressful day and they shouldn't be taking it out on the people that have to, you know, keep their boat ashore or above water. Even if things aren't going well with you, you got to mask it, fake it, you know, fake happiness. don't put that on the people that actually have to get the work done, including vendors and stuff. Otherwise, once we get past this, once the dust settles, it's going to be hard for you to attract other employees, vendors, and probably capital.
So one of my favorite conversations to have is about over leverage and overpaying. How can you tell if one of your clients is going in, or even yourself, somebody's overpaying when they get into the deal? Like, is there certain ratios or percentages that people should try to hold to when they're buying? Or,
you know what, the way I look at it, and everybody has their different formulas in terms of, you know, what should the expenses per unit be per year, per foot, or what the expense ratio relative to revenue. There's a bunch of different ways to kind of calculate. It all boils down to, in my mind, the investments that I make, I'm always buying price per pound. So if I'm looking at a property that's running very well, let's call it a 1982 building. It's running very well on one corner and catty cornered. There's a building that's developed, probably done by the same developer, built in 82, 81, and it's performing, you know, much worse. And I see the stabilized one that I can get for 80 a door, and I'm looking at the one that's not stabilized for 60. I don't get lost in the income statement. I look at, hey, look, I know that it's a factor of, it's usually a factor of three things: condition of the property, where the property is located, and that will get to the price, right? And so if it's located catty-cornered to something that's operating well, then we know that the location is fine. if it's in bad physical condition or there's certain large things that need to be fixed on it, we can at least evaluate that and get that within 10% of what it's going to cost when I'm buying something. So I know, hey, look, I'm buying this at 60. It's going to cost me $5,000 to $6,000 a unit. I don't know if it's going to be 5 or 6, and shoot, it might end up being $6,500 a unit. But then I'm going to have an asset that's going to bring it up to the level of the catty corner property that just sold for 80. I feel comfortable. The third part, which is what the thing earns, that's usually dependent on management. Management is the cheapest thing to fix. Next cheapest thing to fix is going to be physical. You know, I can't shit a roof. A roof needs to be replaced. It costs $500,000. It's the way it is. You know, it's not hiring the right $60,000 a year person who within 4 months turns the property around. There's no shortcut other than getting the most competitive price you can get for a roof, a siding, a sewer line break, whatever. So that's probably one of the most expensive things. And then the most expensive thing that's not even that you can't even change is the location. Right? So if you have the location, you can determine what the physical aspects are and what the deficiencies are. Those are the two big ones that I look at. I'm not highly concerned with how it's being managed. Even if I buy a building and we manage it in the first 4 or 5 months, we picked the wrong person to be on site, and it took 8 months longer to get its wheels under it. There's never been a deal I put together wasn't capitalized properly to have a 6 month delay for me to hit my operation numbers. And that, if you look at the actual amount of money you lose in that scenario, it's not, relative to other things, very big. The big things are the physical things that you miss. And if you're in a bad area, it's never, you're not gonna be able to fix it. You're gonna have to wait for it to be regentrified. Who knows if it'll ever happen, right? So I buy ingredients. So when I buy ingredients, I've noticed, I obviously look at income statements to see, you know, what type of debt, how is it going to service it, and those sorts of things. But when I'm looking at those, that is secondary to what ingredients I'm buying. Because I can always, most of those things you can fix. You can get a cheaper phone plan. You can do all that. You can do what the competitors are doing. When we've seen here over the last 2 years, that, you know, specifically certain people are pushing up pricing. You know, there's a lot of people that bundle money and promote deals, which is, I think, is a very necessary function in the industry. But you want to make sure that you're in with somebody who has skin in the game. And if it doesn't work out, they lose their money too. People tend to be sharper and smarter when they have their own money on the line. And so those are the things where I think some of the motivation of some people promoting these deals over the last couple of years didn't necessarily align with their limited partners and their investors things. So that's where I think that we're going to see a lot of that's where we're going to see a lot of stuff happen over here in the next 6 to 12 months. In terms of just in general, you know, when everybody's an expert, and everybody knows how to make money in real estate, that's typically the time that you need to head for the hills. And then when everybody's scared to death and think it's not worth anything, that's when you need to be a buyer. I mean, that's in a more general sense. I don't know if I'm talking around in circles or not, but that's...
No, this is perfect. This is perfect. The question that I was thinking about as you were going through it is like, okay, so... what are your most success? You're buying ingredients and you're doing price per pound. So you're looking at it on a per unit basis, basically. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's worth this, it's worth that. There's not a whole lot of hocus pocus. You know, people can manipulate the financials, right? They can put income, they can play with expenses, but it's going to bring what it's going to bring. It's kind of the
underlying. Right.
So from your perspective, like, what are... you know, your best property managers doing that are getting the most out of a property? Because I'm sure you guys have had some things that outperform, right? And
right.
The class that we work in, that workforce housing, like, you can be really, really good, or it can get ugly really quick if you're not careful. So, like, are there some best practices or concepts we should?
Yeah, you know, rather than get into super specifics, because I don't want your audience to kind of relate it to a building that it, every property, we may have a manager, and look, we have literally hundreds of managers, and we have may have a manager that does, whose personality does not fit the personality of the property. So let me just give you some examples, if you don't mind, just some analogies to it. We have a woman that we've used for, not used, but employed for 6 or 7 years. She always goes into properties that are 40% occupied. She's a real bulldog, pushes it through, gets it up to 85, 90% full. She is a horrible fit after 85%. So a lot of these properties, you know, need that sheriff in town to get them to a certain extent. And we usually put her on another property that's in need, and she gets compensated for it, right? And then there's the type of personality that's better for that more stabilized property. It starts to become much more focused on customer service, on retention, on sharpening some of the numbers to get it up to that 95%. Now, remember, we're starting at 40. If I put that person who's great on that 85 to 95% property, if I put them on a 40% property, they would get buried. They would, their head would never be above water. It would never get successful. In that same thing, just to kind of think about that, you're talking about housing. Before Corona ever, you know, there was all the, no, we don't want Section 8. Section 8 are bad. Section 8 are bad. Now people are like, if I had 50% Section 8, I know I get paid. You know what I mean? So there's certain different properties that have different requirements. If I'm in a B-plus property in a B-plus area, I want somebody who's very clean, you know, professional looking, speaks well, has a servant's heart, very good at customer service, and that's where they're very strong. Because it's already in a good area, it's going to kind of lease itself, and there's not a lot of grit that needs to be there to collect money and all that stuff. So I'm going to have a personality in that property that'll work fine. Now, if I put that same person who, you know, doesn't let somebody pay after the fifth and then evicts and blah, blah, that's great on that property. But if I put them over in a highly transitional area, let's call it, and where people are, you know, we know in a lot of the workforce housing, if they're not subsidized, they pay you no matter when the third hit, first Friday or the second Friday. It's when payday happens, when you get paid. They typically don't have $2,000 saved up to always stay ahead. So if you went in there and just said, hey, after my, I have my process on the fifth, everybody, you can't come in and pay, you're evicted. Well, look what you're going to have. You have a max exodus. You have 25% of your property, you're going to be biting your own nose to spite your face. So I don't like to give super detailed answers with regards to that, because every property is different. But what I would say is the properties that typically perform best, and they always have the, everyone has its own different personality, the property, is the ones where the manager believes in what they're selling. So they love their property. They believe in what they're selling. They're being treated with respect by their employer and dignity. And those people tend to, not even tend to, 99% of the time, those properties perform better. When somebody is treated like they're a number, they're not treated with dignity, and they're put in the wrong position, you know, maybe it's over their head or way under their ability level, then you get the opposite. And so I would say that is the most important thing with regards to getting the right staff on property. As far as certain properties that are on major arterials, they have very little issues with marketing. You don't typically need to do a whole bunch of Facebook and all this online stuff. Whereas if we have another property that's a little bit hidden, that's becomes more important. I think where the audience should probably listen here is that we haven't always had the best online presence in terms of property websites, even our own personal website, and a lot of the ratings things going in there, and having a systematic approach to keep our ratings we haven't done that because it really wasn't needed up to this point. I see that we've really doubled down our efforts in that that realm, because I see post-COVID, post-corona, I think there's going to be more, even on that workforce housing, the person who's not typically always looking at ratings and going to Yelp and everything, I think they're going to tend to go more to that, because I don't see people being comfortable, at least for the next half a year, going in and out of 15 offices and 30 units to shop a property. I think they're really going to lean on online presence more. And so, you know, wherever you are in that spectrum right now, you need to kind of double your efforts, double your budget for the online presence. It's always been a buzzword for the last 5 years, but a lot of people spent a bunch of money on that and didn't really get the results, or they just saw their rents going up and they were attributing it to that. It wasn't that, but now that's a very important aspect of the business.
What's up, guys? It's your host, Jerome. I just want to let you know we launched Myers Methods in the fall of 2019 with the ambition to inspire a new breed of multifamily investor. If you are interested in getting into multifamily or scaling your current business, hop over to our website at MyersMethods.com to grab your free 4-step guide on how to get the ball rolling in multifamily. Now, let's get back to the episode.
So, I made the mistake early on of single family property manager on a 20 unit.
Mm-hmm.
Very well. What should the listeners be looking for in a property manager? We've talked about the differences between like ABCs, but is there a certain criteria or thought process we should be applying when we're interviewing the property managers?
Yeah. So if you're, I'm going to cut it a little bit by ABC, a little bit, even though you've spoken about that, I'll just touch on that. On A property, I'm probably not the best resource to tell you. I would say that that's, you go, if it's an A property that you're buying, you need to go to a management company that specializes in A properties in that region. A property management companies can be a little bit more nationwide than C and B, in my opinion, and I'll qualify that here in a second. In terms of C, B, and even more importantly, C, I think you definitely need to get a company that has a heavy focus on efficiencies with respect to maintenance, make readies, you know, a lot of the expense side is very, very important. That's what blows out of the water quickly. I mean, you can have great revenues, and if you have a management company that's not equipped to either bring the right vendor in or do it themselves, a sewer replacement, you can have a $30,000 cost that could have been an $8,000 or $9,000 cost. So I would say in the C primarily, but even in the B, you really want one that has the chops and the maintenance make ready that department. I believe, and this can be, people can have different opinions, I really think that you should have somebody that already has a presence in that geographic area. Doesn't mean they have to have a property within two blocks away, but if you're in Oklahoma City and the metro in Oklahoma City, you really ought to think twice about going with, you know, a company that doesn't even have a presence there yet. You're just going to fly somebody in Oklahoma City to oversee your management. And the reason I say that is C class, B class, they're much more management intensive than A. And really, there's not as much magic as to it as you think. Most important is who you put in the front desk in the front seat of the property, right? But secondly, this is very important. This is the success of property management on a third-party basis. It's called unannounced visits. And you need to have regular unannounced visits by the supervisor to make sure things are going well. Physical presence. That's a very, very important thing. Now put your feet in the shoes of the property management company. Let's say that they have all of their properties in Dallas-Fort Worth, and you bought a property in Longview, which is, let's call it an hour and a half, 2 hour drive more or less from Dallas. If they don't have a presence out there, then for them to do an unannounced visit, they're paying somebody to drive out there and drive back. Now, typically these properties only underwrite a certain amount of fees, right? So what does that property management company do? I always tell people, look, I always have to check two boxes. Number one is we need to be able to provide a great service, and that involves lots of supervision. And number two, and just as important, is I got to make a profit. So I say, if you go with somebody else that's lower price or something like that, you're not even helping yourself, because that management company is going to make sure they check that second box. What they're going to do is just send people out less. And you saving a few bucks is going to cost you a few thousand dollars. So local presence, go look at the properties that they manage already. And, you know, put fillers out there to other professionals in the industry. And that's the biggest thing I would do. On A, I don't want to be an expert. I don't have the secret sauce on A-class properties.
Well, it was really cool as you talked about making a profit. I think a lot of people feel like the property manager doesn't feel like they're actually on their team. They're trying to figure out how they can make as much money as possible by doing things with the most convenient resource, which usually is the most expensive resource.
Yeah. Yeah. Here's how I'm a businessman first. I just happen to be in real estate. And, you know, I grew up with, the contractor didn't show up for my kitchen, blah, blah, blah. You can't get a good I get my surfboard shaped. He's always 2 months behind and da, da, da. And I don't really believe that those industries have just attracted people that do less for more. I don't believe that. A lot of times you need to look through it through a different visor, right? That I'm looking at a contractor to come and rehab my kitchen, right? I know that he's feast or famine. He's always going to say, yes, I have time to do that work, because he knows for 3 months of the year, he's not going to be working, right? So they bunch up a lot of their contracts, and then they walk the tightrope of getting each one and keeping people barely satisfied. That's on your home remodel stuff, right? I know that that's, as a business person, that's what their math has to be to keep the lights on and stay in business. If you're kind of a simpleton and you go, well, no, it's just contractors are all POSs and they're all liars and da-da-da-da-da, that's a simple binary question. And you really don't come to a higher level of understanding of how to solve the problem. In terms of property management, if you get somebody with a good reputation, good enough, locally, that's there locally, and then you keep them to task on hitting the projections that they hit outside of a COVID-19 thing happening. If they're doing that, then that has to be good enough. In terms of most of these decent-sized management companies that we compete with, and we take, obviously over the years, we've taken lots of business from lots of different management companies. We've lost a few deals along the way as well, but obviously we've done more than we've lost. Most of the time, it's more of an issue of incompetence, overgrowth of the company. It's not typically, only about 1 out of 10 times is it an actual integrity issue. Because typically they're not above 5 or 6,000 units if they don't have a reasonable level of integrity. I've had millions of chances to rip people off. They get a great reputation and it spreads, and then they get 3 times the size of the business, and they weren't prepared or don't have the talent to build the staff to service 3 times of the business. That's typically where they trip. It literally is probably 10% of the time where we're like, the guy doesn't have integrity, they're stealing money, look at this, that, and the other thing. Those people are usually out of the business before we've ever even shown up. So that's typical. In terms of our business, we don't claim to be the lowest fee in town, but you know what you're paying for. Everything's up in your face. Here's what the payroll is. We don't mark it up. All your parts that you're buying, we don't mark shit up. Here's what the management fees are. Yes, they're 0.5% more than somebody else quoted you, and I don't care. This is what I need. We need to make a living too, right? And so if you want the good service, but higher fee doesn't always mean better service. But that's why we tend to be less, negotiable on some of these fees. So It's when you put somebody into an angle or you get the person that'll do the project for 2% less on the fee. Instead of doing 5, they'll do 3. You need to, in a practical sense, know that that person has to make money. And so they're going to make money either by providing less supervision or nickel and diming everything, right?
Yeah. So a lot of people want to pay for predictability, right? If you got to guess each month on what something's going to be or how the bill is going to come out, or questioning whether or not that thing actually had to be done or it was done to generate a work order so they could make some more profit.
That's
when you really get in trouble. So I'll ask a question.
In the larger buildings, what I could say specifically is, you know, don't go with the single family. The single family home model is totally different on the management side. And so they have to charge to replace a door and a markup, or they wouldn't make any money, right? There would be nobody managing single family homes. In multifamily, which, you know, our kind of key area is, it has to support a full-time manager and maintenance on site. And that number is usually 65, 70 units, up to 1 million units if it existed, right? There should be no markup. The industry norm at those size buildings is no markup. It's the fee on the gross receipts, pass through on the payroll, usually a payroll fee that it's a pass through on the ADP or whatever service they use, and usually some nominal software fee. That's really how it should be. And that's really what the competitive market, we've seen other people's management agreements, they're all pretty similar in that respect. There should not be them getting, they shouldn't be getting paid again from a vendor or something like that. Something like that happens, then you need to fire the person pretty quickly. Because that's just an integrity issue. And look, they have control of a lot of your money all the time, right?
They do. I think integrity is it is the most important piece of the relationship. If you can't trust the person with running your business, and I personally believe property management is the most important piece of the team, right? Because they're in the seat the longest. And people are pulling the levers. I mean, day to day answering the phone and being the voice to the customer and everything else. So,
there's a lot of people that can make real fancy spreadsheets with neat macros and all the rest of it. And if the person in the seat at the office can't make that happen, you can take that Excel sheet and shove it up. You know, it's worthless. It's not. I know very wealthy owners of real estate that up to about 2-3 years ago, they did everything on the back of an envelope. I mean, it's not rocket science. You're collecting money. You're paying for things to get fixed. Making it more efficient is better. You should watch our video. We do methodically and have, you know, a very sophisticated system. But that's not the difference. The difference is you just need to make the nickels gather up the quickest. That's definitely what it is. What I would say that a lot of people get wrong is property management companies, integrity is the way they typically do it is they're not giving you enough service. It's not that they're paying themselves too much. It's that they just cut back the supervision. And that's where it's constant battle. We've been in periods where we felt like we were a few regional short and push and tried to get a hire and did it. I mean, you're constantly fighting that battle, but it's not something where that shouldn't be something that's in place for a long time where you don't have enough people to oversee the properties and visit them very often.
Wow. And so I imagine you guys enjoy getting involved prior to the property closing, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah, we typically, and this is something else that I would recommend everybody watch the video because it kind of gives a synopsis of what we do. But we'll actually do an operating forecast, or it's basically a budget, but we don't underwrite your debt. So we will do an operating forecast for the property before you make an offer. right? So we typically don't, we don't want things spammed to us. So we expect the person to have actually done their own underwriting, the initial smell test. Because what we'll do is, hey, send us the T12. We don't want your underwriting. I want my people to start. We really want our people to start flat-footed. I just know human nature. People will go to the direction that they see. So say, keep your stuff. Let's send us the T12, the rent roll. And then what we will do is, you know, we'll do all of the analysis in terms of the numbers and how we would run it. But we'll also send out somebody to do a physical market survey. So we're not just getting it off of CoStar. So if we look at that property and we look across the street and you know, the broker package is saying that it should be getting $200 in rent and unit more. And we go, well, look, they have stainless steel appliances, all new siding, a dog park, you know, whatever else. And yours doesn't have any of that. And we're going to spend $6,000 a unit for to even make $150 more, whatever that is. So we want physically looked at the property. We'll have somebody, and we have a team. And a lot of times we want somebody that matches the demographic. So literally me going into Oak Cliff or South Dallas and act like I'm renting an apartment, the manager knows I'm not renting there. You know what I mean? I don't fit the demographic. They know I'm shopping. So that. One of the benefits of having 1,000 employees and about 750 of them here in DFW, we'll send somebody that matches the demographics, worked for us for a long time, and they'll go in there and shop that property. Then they'll shop the properties that we outline for them near that property. So we get a physical assessment of what the property is and what the subject property is, and then we'll know what we have to do in terms of to get that property, if it's possible, to the status of some of the better performing properties in the area. That is very important. We'll do that before you even make an offer. So that you get yours, you put it next to ours, they kind of, the stars unite, great. And you know, you extrapolate to get the price you want to offer. Or you say, hey, look, why did you do this? Why did you do that? Oh yeah, maybe we missed that. Or maybe you look at yours and you go, what? I have this underwritten. You go, hey, well, you're being too aggressive here or there or whatever. And so you kind of, you get through those numbers. Now that process we do charge $100 for. I lose money on everyone that's done. Remember, I'm sending somebody, spending all day doing all this stuff. The reason we do that is then when they go make an offer, then we go and do the due diligence. You really need to watch the video. It'll give you a lot of detail. We, on a 100 unit deal, we'll do a 30,000 data point aggregation of every single item, 300 points per interior. And then it'll sort up to whether it needs to be replaced or repaired or it's fine. And it'll aggregate the pricing. So we'll know down to the unit within about a 5 to 7% of accuracy what it's gonna cost, right? And it's through aggregation, it's through an app that we develop proprietary. So when we get through that, we still say, hey, look, this is based, we haven't went through all the units. We put it under contract. We still need to walk 100, you know, that 100 unit deal, let's use that as an example. We need to walk at least 95 of them, of the units. And we'll do this full score system. You'll get all of that. If it's the same as our assumptions, it'll be great. But we reserve the right to always change the numbers after due diligence, right? It's been a lot more, there's been a little bit more stress with that over the last couple of years here locally, because almost every deal required earnest money that goes hard day one, right? To even compete on some of the deals here locally. And so, you know, it has put the client in a tough predicament sometimes. We're like, hey, we uncovered this issue with whatever mold on the back of this part of the bathroom on all these unit types, and we think it could be this cost. Whatever myriad reasons it could be, and they already have $200,000 hard. It's been a tough buyer's market here, as of late. So, I think that dynamic is going to change. We'll see. I don't think that earnest money. I don't think people are giving up liquidity just to look at deals anymore. So that'll make it kind of operate as a more normal real estate transactional environment. That's the big thing. I always tell people, look, you make your money when you buy an asset. You just cash out when you sell it, right? But you really make your money when you buy it. So you need to do all of the homework that you could possibly do. Pay now, play now, pay now, play later. Or you can play now and pay later. So jump through the hoops, do whatever the hell you have to do at due diligence. Because once you own it, you own it.
And
you know, the other little big advice I could tell people is that your best advocate as an investor is yourself, right? You are your own best advocate. The management company is number two because we have a continuing relationship with you. So we want to be right. So, and if we have an unsatisfied customer, it's not a profitable contract. So we really want to be right. We're probably the second biggest advocate. Everybody else in the business isn't meant to be an advocate of yours. Don't expect it. Don't be mad when the broker's numbers are a little bit more aggressive than what's reality. And that's just the way, I mean, that's normal. It's common sense. If they were selling your asset, you'd want them to put it in the best possible light as well. So you need to advocate for yourself, do your own homework, and lean on the right people. And I mean, that's very important. I've never had an expectation that I pull out the financials that it's in a listing package and get angry because I think they're too aggressive. I'm like, well, no shit, they're too aggressive. He's trying to sell it. He gets paid the day it closes, he gets paid, right? Or she.
And they're done. They get to walk away.
And I'm not saying that they want it to go well as well. You know, it's not an indictment of brokers. I'm just saying you got to look where people's incentives are lined up. Your incentive's most important. Management company's number two because they want to keep the contract, and it's one of those relationships. It's a gift that keeps on giving, bad or good. So we want to be right as well. The broker wants to be right, but he's not going to lose sleep if he's wrong, right?
No, he doesn't have anything at risk, especially after the transaction closes.
He does have his reputation at risk, so there'll be a little bit. He wants it to go well. If he could choose, he'd always want it to go well. He just doesn't have that much at risk compared to everybody else.
Yeah, so I've bought some stuff, and the broker just kind of does the matrix thing where you dodge the bullets, right? Because I'm just telling you what they told me. I'm representing the seller, right? They're always representing. The seller said, what do you want me to do? I'm like, well, I guess I should have found it. Got it. You got me.
Yeah. Yeah, and most of the time they don't know. You know, I've listed properties before, and they're not poking through everything. That's not what their function is. It's to market your property to as many people as possible, disclose what they legally have to, and that's about it. In fact, that's their fiduciary responsibilities to the person that they're selling it for, right?
Yep. They're there. Who's paying them is the person that they're relate or, you know, engage with. And
I have a broker's license. They have a fiduciary responsibility to them,
right?
Which to the overall public, they just have a responsibility to be truthful. So right. If they know, they have to disclose it. Yeah. If they don't know, they're not supposed to poke, you know?
So the last question I have, because this has been amazing, is what words of wisdom do you have for the listeners?
I thought I already did. Pay now, play later. Play now, pay later. My dad's been teaching me that since little. Now, what I would say is, I think you kind of alluded to this before, is the very biggest mistake that you can make is to overpay for an asset and or undercapitalize an asset. Things are not always going to be smooth and easy, and that's just not the way real estate works. You're not buying a T-bill. It's not the exact same revenue and payout every month. Don't have that expectation. That would be my biggest thing. I think the second thing is who manages it. The number one factor is definitely what you pay for the asset and how you capitalize it. So do your homework up front. Make sure you do as much homework as you can. Don't go there with fear and act like that Armageddon's happening, then that no deal will work. But you know, you need to have a plan B and plan C. That would be my biggest thing that I would lean on to people. Just one other thing is you should probably go to WaynerMultifamily.com, watch a video, and learn from the masters.
Right.
That's my other word of wisdom.
Awesome, man. I am extremely grateful that you spend this time with us, sharing with our listeners, and I look forward to talking to you soon, man.
Yeah, you got my cell number, so reach out to me whenever you want, dude. And we'll when you're in Dallas, we'll have a scotch or whatever you drink, and we'll hang out in my backyard a little bit. We'll go visit some properties, but watch my video, and if you have a website or whatever, share it with everybody. Just so if you want to get a hold of me, what was it? info@WehnerMultifamily.com. That's WEHNER Multifamily.com. And watch the video. That'll give you a good synopsis of our service, at least on the due diligence side.
Thank you so much.
You made it to this juncture, so you really love what we shared on this episode of Myers Methods Presents Multifamily Missteps. Do us a favor. Give us a 5-star rating. Give us a review. And share this with somebody who's interested in multifamily investing. Until the next time, the pack is with you.